From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi sparked angry protests and global criticism over a decree that expanded his powers and reduced judicial oversight of his actions. Critics call it a power grab, while Morsi's supporters said the move is necessary to protect the democratically elected government from a judiciary loyal to ousted President Hosni Mubarak. In our opening hour, we discuss recent events in Egypt and how the United States should respond. Our guests include Stephen Cook from the Council on Foreign Relations, Soraya Sarhadi Nelson, foreign correspondent for NPR based in Cairo, and Shibli Talhami, Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. That's all next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. 2 years nearly after the revolution that led to the overthrow of Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, a seizure of new powers last week by democratically elected former Muslim Brotherhood leader and Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi led to violent protests as tens of thousands called for him to step down over a decree which he set forward on Thursday that would have shielded his decisions from judicial review until a new constitution is ratified. The president handed down his decree after receiving praise from the United States and other countries for his efforts in brokering a fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, and also ensuring a $4.8 billion international monetary fund loan. Markets declined, however, in Egypt after the decree, and three of President Morsi's advisors resigned, and a number of judges and prosecutors went on strike. Yesterday, the president met with the Supreme Judicial Council, Egypt's highest judicial body, and backed an apparent compromise on the extension of his powers, but did not quash the decree, as many of the protesters had demanded. A major protest strike has been called for today by opponents of President Morsi. And in this morning's opening Forum Hour, we want to discuss the ongoing conflict in Egypt and the role the United States is playing in it. Joining us from Cairo is Sarhadi Nelson, and she is foreign correspondent for National Public Radio on assignment now in Cairo. Soraya, good to have you back. Welcome.
Good morning, Michael. Good to be back.
Good morning to you. It's good evening in Egypt, and I'm anxious to catch up with what's going on there. But let me introduce the other guests we have with us here this morning. They include Shibli Talhami, Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution. His new book, which he co-authored, is called The Peace Puzzle, America's Quest for Arab-Israeli Peace, 1989 to 2011. Welcome back to Forum, Shibli Talhami.
Always a pleasure.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Stephen A. Cook back with us, Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies with the Council on Foreign Relations, author of The Struggle for Egypt from Nasser to Tahrir Square, and welcome, Stephen Cook.
Pleasure to be with you, Michael.
Glad to have you. Let me go first to Cairo and Soraya Sarhadi Nelson and find out, actually, if we could, right up to the moment with you, Soraya, what's going on. These big demonstrations were called by opponents of Morsi for today, and they've called for a general strike. But there was apparently some kind of compromise hammered out, just verbal, not in writing. Where do things stand?
Well, actually, there was no compromise. There was sort of a smoke and mirrors game going on where, if you'll forgive the analogy, but basically what happened is that President Morsi told the top judges, the highest judicial authority, as you mentioned, that he meant no disrespect, that he certainly respected their independence, et cetera, but that he would stick to sovereign issues, except after that, the spokesman for him made it clear that actually nothing had changed in the constitutional declaration he had made the week before, which gave him or gives him basically unchecked powers. What they have said is that he will give it up. Statements have come out saying that he will give it up after the constitution is ratified. Some people say it's after the new parliamentary elections. But all of that is very vague. And so the judges in the various courts, forget the judicial authority for a minute. The judges in each court system basically throughout the country, they've been meeting and they decided to go ahead with their strike. So you have a lot of courts now that are, in fact, taking part in this nationwide strike. At the same time, you have many, many people pouring into Tahrir Square in Cairo. There are apparently protests going on elsewhere as well. I don't have up-to-date information on that, but Tahrir Square is packed. I mean, we have not seen it like this since Mr. Morsi was elected, in fact. I should note that there is a pro-Morsi demonstration that was going on in Alexandria, the northern city of Alexandria, which, of course, is Egypt's second largest.
Well, forgive me. There was, I believe, also a pro-Morsi demonstration called for in Cairo, but the president essentially brokered it so that it would be called off. At this point, you know, just how strong is the opposition?
Well, I think they're united in their desire to see Morsi back down. Some would take it as far as wanting to see Mr. Morsi go, but they're not united in really how to approach it or what to do or what comes after. I mean, even the reasons for being out there. I spoke to a number of people who are out there tonight. Some of them were there because of the decrees. Others were there just because the same situations that led to the revolution back in 2011, early 2011, still exists on the ground now. I mean, you have high unemployment, you have people hungry, you know, the economy is in trouble, you have no police reform, no judicial reform. No interior ministry or justice sector reform, so security forces are still harassing and haranguing people. And so they feel like the revolution is left undone. But you ask them about the decrees, they're like, yeah, well, that's just the latest step. They don't really see it as the thing that drove them out.
Well, how many of the Egyptians who are out in the streets see this as an attempt essentially to replicate the kind of autocracy that was that they lived under for so many years under Mubarak, as opposed to really believing President Morsi, who says, look, I'm just trying to root out this old regime and get rid of the weevils, I think was the way he put it.
Well, it's mixed. I mean, there's definitely a lot of divisions even among the people who oppose Mr. Morsi or his tactics about what he's done. I think there's less. It's amazing. You would think that with their newfound freedoms that perhaps they wouldn't be so quick to give them up. But they're much more concerned about having stability. And if Mr. Morsi can convince them that he can bring that stability, even if it's in an autocratic fashion, I think a lot of people might fall in line behind him. The problem is that many people see this as the Muslim Brotherhood sort of bringing forth their agenda that for decades they've tried to do. I mean, that they've wanted to have power. Now they have power, and they're trying to make sure they can hang on to it. That's how a lot of people are interpreting it. And so this is why you're seeing a lot of opposition to what Mr. Morsi has done.
Soraya Sarhadi Nelson, again with us from Cairo, foreign correspondent for National Public Radio on assignment in Cairo. And Shibli Talhami is Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, co-author of a new book called The Peace Puzzle, from all about America's quest for Arab-Israeli peace between 1989 and 2011. And Professor Talhami, I mean, this seems, again, like Islamists against, democratic liberals, coalition calling themselves United Front and all that. Can we have another revolution here?
Well, first of all, let's remember that Egyptians are divided. I mean, yes, Morsi was elected democratically, but look at the results of the election. In the first round of presidential election, he received only 26% running against 12 other candidates, and then ultimately, he barely won.
Won by 3.5%.
Establishment candidate. So Egypt is divided. We know that. People did rally behind him after he won, but the suspicion remains. It's very deep, and on both sides. On the one hand, I mean, Morsi is suspicious of the judiciary. They have taken steps. He sees them as remnants of the former regime. They have taken steps that went against the Muslim Brotherhood and even his presidency, and he's worried about what they might do vis-a-vis the Constitutional Assembly. But on the other hand, you know, people are worried about the kind of the history of the Muslim Brotherhood. Let me give you three examples here that add up to a lot of worries. First, you know, they said they're not going to field a presidential candidate. Then they did exceptionally well, better than they even expected in the parliamentary election. They turned around and decided to field their presidential candidate. That wasn't particularly expected. The minute Morsi was elected, he faced this crisis in the Sinai. He rallied people behind him. He scored well by taking on the militants. The next morning, he uses the power and the rallying behind him to remove his defense minister. In this particular case, he gets a lot of support both internationally and at home for mediating the Gaza ceasefire. And the next morning, he uses that power to grab onto more power. So there is a lot of suspicion among, it's not just the, you know, the liberals, the people, even among some people who voted for him, wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt. So I think there is a crisis of trust right now that is huge, and it's going to hang on what happens with the writing of the Constitution, because that's really the big issue of the day.
Well, that, in fact, is the, well, pretty much the explanation that he's been offering. The Islamist-dominated lower house of parliament was essentially dissolved by court order, and that was back on June 15th, and he certainly has overstepped his executive powers, as seen by the Egyptian opposition to him August 12th and now again on November 22nd. So we've got what seems like, head-to-head here, don't we?
There's no question about it, and I think really, at the core of this, both for him and for a lot of his opponents, what is going to happen on the issue of the Constitution, and who's and will they have a recourse if this assembly puts in place a Constitution they don't support? And that's really that's where it's at. And what we see, we don't really have public opinion polls to know exactly how many people oppose the powers. I think, as Soraya indicated, there are a lot of people who are really tired of what they see as anarchy, and they want they want more stability. I mean, that happens always in transitions. But what you find in terms of at least the enthusiasm of the opposition and the mobilization of the opposition coming together, people who typically have not cooperated, leaders of the opposition like, from Amr Musa to Al-Baradei to Abdin Sabahi, who had not, cooperated, coming together, and look at the numbers on the streets. I mean, it does tell you that the public, the opposition, is energized, and that is obviously a new factor, regardless of the numbers.
Shibli Talhami again, Anwar Sadat, Professor for Peace and Development, University of Maryland, with us from Silver Spring, Maryland. And Stephen A. Cook is here with us as well this morning. He's again Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies with the Council on Foreign Relations and author for The Struggle for Egypt, From Nasser to Tahrir Square. And Stephen, let's talk about the U.S. role in all this. I mean, Egypt needs the United States, and the United States is trying to not necessarily dictate, but concerned about dictatorship.
Well, I think that's certainly the case. The United States does not want to be seen as directly involved in Egypt's transition. However, this change of circumstances in which President Morsi has issued this decree and the response to it calls for the United States to say something. After all, since Mubarak's fall, even before Mubarak's fall, the Obama administration has signaled that it wants to be on the so-called right side of history and with the people who are demanding freedom and change and democracy. Thus far, however, we seem to have Washington has seemed to have reverted to form. And there's been a reluctance to criticize President Morsi and this move and to essentially relegate this as an internal debate in Egypt. But I think as the numbers of people turn out in Tahrir Square and we see what happens in other parts of the country, I know Soraya Sahadi Nelson is in Cairo. I'm following things on Twitter as I'm listening to the conversation. And there are demonstrations in places in secondary cities like Tanta and Damanhur where someone was killed the other day. So this is not something that is necessarily going to be confined to Tahrir Square. And I think that it's important for the United States to remind President Morsi, who, by the way, was actually looking to burnish his revolutionary credentials in an odd way through these decrees, that the United States should remind him that the uprising was about democracy and accountability, and that even if the people in Tahrir Square aren't members of the Muslim Brotherhood, they too are Egyptians and are expressing legitimate demands.
Well, the real question in some ways boils down to just how much is Morsi doing this temporarily to carry the revolution forward, as you suggested, or perhaps taking an autocratic role, which would perhaps not make this temporary at all. In other words, Iran comes to mind, and he did go to Iran, and he seemed to many like he's consolidating his power here.
Well, I mean, closer to home than Iran is actually Egypt. You have to remember that the emergency laws, which came into being in the 1950s and were in place almost continuously for more than three decades in Egypt, were temporary. They, Mubarak and before him Sadat, pushed through the People's Assembly legislation that renewed over and over again the temporary emergency law that essentially put Egypt under a form of military rule. And I think that's what people are concerned concerned about. I think that Morsi miscalculated. I think that somewhere within the councils of the Muslim Brotherhood, they believe that by going after Mubarak-era judges, by shielding the constituent assembly from dissolution by these Mubarak-era judges, by announcing that they would retry officials from the Mubarak era for crimes during the uprising, that they would that this would actually play well in Tahrir Square. But in fact, they did not understand that Egyptians had seen this kind of thing before, and many of them just weren't going to tolerate it.
Again, Stephen A. Cook, Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies with the Council on Foreign Relations. Let me go back to Cairo and Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson, who's foreign correspondent for NPR and is on assignment in Cairo. Well, how does the military play into this as you see things, Soraya? Excuse me. Because I know El Baradei, among others, has talked about the military restoring law and order, and it's not necessarily in the pocket of Mohamed Morsi.
Well, he does have the support of the younger officers. I mean, this is how he was able to get rid of SCAF, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, that was sort of the de facto leader of Egypt during the transition phase up until, I guess it was the summer. And so he has, I don't think that it's an automatic, given that the military is going to use this opportunity to come out, because again, I think the younger officers have pledged their support to the existing government or the existing president. But that doesn't mean there isn't a danger there. I mean, that's one of the reasons that that Morsi, in fact, took these actions, or the belief is that he took these actions because he was concerned that the courts were going to rule or somehow restore SCAF to power, and that would just create a huge mess and you know, just something that neither he nor the Brotherhood would tolerate. But having said that, there's no sign of the military anywhere near. I mean, I haven't seen them downtown. I haven't seen them near Tahrir Square or whatever. You do see police. And again, they're actually engaging in violent clashes in some areas that are sort of adjacent to the square, particularly around the U.S. Embassy area. It's unclear to me that the U.S. Embassy is really the target. I think this has just sort of been a running battle that's been going on sort of low level in the background with young people who many here refer to as thugs or ultras. And they've been throwing rocks at the police who in exchange fire tear gas and that sort of thing. But there isn't really a sign yet of any intervention by the military the way we saw during the revolution, back in early 2011.
And what are you seeing as far as the Salafis in terms of they are pretty strong in their support of President Morsi, just like the Islamic Brotherhood?
Well, I think they're allied with them. I don't think they agree with everything, but they see this as their opportunity to put a stamp on the new constitution, to share in power in Egypt. They're not out today. The Salafists, as well as the Muslim Brotherhood, at least in Cairo, agreed not to hold demonstrations or counter-protests, if you will, because there was a fear of bloodshed. I think even Morsi realizes that if enough blood is shed, that perhaps this could trigger another uprising or revolt that would end up, casting him and the Brotherhood from power. They don't want that. So he can count on the Salafist support to some extent. But there certainly have been huge disagreements as well between the Salafists and the Brotherhood. I mean, the Salafists don't really see the Brotherhood as really ensuring that Islamic law is applied and that Islam is the foundation for the Constitution the way they would like to see it.
And let me go back, if I may, Shilby Talhami, to you. How do you see this in terms of the sort of capital that's been raised for President Morsi as a result of not only brokering the peace between Gaza and Israel, fragile though it is, but also pretty much the sense of his being now seen perhaps as a leader in the Arab world? You have to ask the question, how much of this has maybe gone to his head?
I don't know about gone to his head, but clearly he thought that empowered him, because I think, as I suggested earlier, there's a pattern that every time he feels empowered and supported, and I think the Muslim Brotherhood as a group, they turn around and try to use that leverage to enhance power. But I do agree principally with what Steve said, which is that I think he really miscalculated. I think if he knew this would be the reaction, this is probably not what he did. And let me also say that I don't really see the comparison with either Iran or even Egypt in the 1950s. And I think this is not the 1950s and 1970s. We're in 2012. And if we look at what's happening with the Arab uprising, what is the Arab awakening, it is really an empowerment of the public in an era of the information revolution, the likes of which we have never seen in the Middle East. And we're not likely, and that's not likely to go away. I mean, the fact that you have all these tens of thousands of people in the streets is an indication of that. And add to this that, you know, Nasser in the 1950s had a control of the military. The Muslim Brotherhood does not fully have a control of the military. If anything, still, even though they've appointed some of their own people at the top, or at least people they're comfortable with, the institution isn't really necessarily there. They can't really use it immediately as a coercive method to entrench themselves in power. So I don't think that's what we're facing. I think we're facing what all of us have expected, that it is in a transitional period from what was entrenched authoritarianism into an open democratic experiment in a divided country. You're going to have all sorts of ups and downs. I don't think this is more than that. Whether or not they'll resolve it quickly, I don't know, but I just don't see it as going either the Iranian model or even Egypt in the 1950s.
Well, it's still dysfunctional, and there's certainly problems and concerns about rule of law and about checks and balances that have come out as a result of this latest crisis. And I'm wondering, Stephen A. Cook, when you look at it from your perspective, you've said in your book since 1952 there's been no ideology really to speak of for the most part where Egypt is concerned. Do we have an ideology now in terms of the Muslim Brotherhood? Because
well, I think the important point is that in this environment where after 60 years of strongmen, in which you know, Kamal Abdel Nasser, through what we now call Nasserism, was able to capture the imaginations of people for a short period of time. Sadat tried in his own way. Mubarak never even bothered to try that. Now, after those three presidents and 60 years of, as Shibley said, entrenched authoritarianism, you now have a massive competition over who is going to define Egypt, what form of government it has, the principles by which the people and the government relate to each other, what Egypt stands for, what its place is in the world. The Muslim Brotherhood has one view. There are others that have different views. And what we're seeing right now, and this is what we're likely to see for some time, are these periodic spasms of, if not violence, but people power expressing their dissatisfaction with whichever group happens to be up at the moment, their view of how things should be ordered. Clearly, there is opposition to the Brotherhood. They have not been able to run the political table. Ultimately, that's a healthy thing, unless this turns into some sort of new type of entrenched authoritarianism. I don't think that's going to happen, because at the first whiff that Morsi might be going down this road, and again, I think it was ultimately a miscalculation, you have tens of thousands of people, if not more, pouring into the streets to demand that he rescind these decrees.
As we speak, we should mention, I'm coming up on a break, so let me do this, if I may, Stephen Cook. I want to invite listeners to join this conversation with any questions or comments they might have about the ongoing situation in Egypt. You are welcome to join us and cordially invited to do so. Our toll-free number is available to you, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite, so feel free to join us now. 866-733-6786 is the number for you to call. Again, that's toll-free from anywhere. 866-733-6786. A number of other ways to register your concerns or the way you are reading things or perhaps what you'd like to contribute to this conversation in the way of questions or comments. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any of your questions or comments on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment, or go to our Facebook page. But join us by phone at 866-733-6786. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi sparked angry protests as well as global criticism over a decree that he issued that expanded his powers and reduced judicial oversight of his actions, and critics called it a power grab, while his supporters said the move was necessary to protect the democratically elected government from a judiciary loyal to ousted President Hosni Mubarak. We're updating you on the situation in Egypt. There are protests going on as we speak. Thousands of people in Tahrir Square again and in Alexandria, and a general strike, in fact, was called for today. There has been a meeting that was essentially Well, it went on yesterday between President Morsi and the Supreme Judicial Council, met on Monday, and there are still ongoing questions of what was hammered out of anything as a result of that. Big questions about the Egyptian constitution and when indeed or how that will be hammered out. Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson is with us from Cairo. She is foreign correspondent with National Public Radio on assignment in Cairo. And with us by phone also this morning is Professor Shibli Talhami, Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution. His newest book, co-authored, is The Peace Puzzle, America's Quest for Arab-Israeli Peace, 1989 to 2011. We're also talking with Stephen Cook, Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies with the Council on Foreign Relations and author of The Struggle for Egypt, From Nasser to Tahrir Square. We want to bring our listeners into this. And again, you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or join the conversation by going to our website and posting any comments or questions you have there, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or go to our Facebook page. And you can also, of course, join us live by phone at 866-733-6786. Let's go to our callers, and we begin. Shahab. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Thanks for the show. I actually have been following this Egypt situation for a while. Of course, we had our own connection with Wael Ghanim, the Google executive who was part of that whole uprising. And I wanted to draw your attention and your guest's attention to something that's going on in Pakistan, which is also, had similar issues with democracy as Egypt, a strong military, and not a very well-entrenched tradition of democracy. They've had this struggle with judiciary and executive for the past 4.5 years, pretty much the entire tenure of the government that is now approaching elections. And I, looking at that example, there are parallels strong enough for me to believe that this is a minor issue. This is not going to be as big a problem. I don't see this having the staying power necessarily in Egypt. I think this is just a minor issue, and it's probably going to go away as democracy progresses.
Yeah, Shahab, it's a sanguine view of things. I don't know, Shibli Talhami, if you want to comment, particularly on the analogy to Pakistan.
Well, I really don't have much to say on Pakistan. I haven't followed the Pakistani elections very closely to comment on that. But I think the most important point, obviously, that is made here is that this could be temporary and nothing major. Yes, at a macro level, where when you look at it from, in transition, this is the sort of thing you expect. But these episodes like this one over really critical issues, it's defining the powers of the presidency and, more importantly, ultimately defining the Constitution, are huge battles. Some of the most important battles, perhaps I would say, that the battle over the constitution for Egypt is the most important battle the Egyptians are going to have in the following the revolution. And so it's not a small battle. There are differences really across society, and how it comes out is going to matter a lot. It may not be the decrees per se, because the decrees of the president probably will be resolved in some way. I think he has every interest in finding a way to move forward. That is President Morsi, but I think the issue of the Constitution is still ahead, and it's going to be a difficult battle.
It's going to be thorny any way you look at it, and I thank the caller. I want to move on to more of your calls, and let me go to Abdul. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to state that this revolution remains incomplete. It's actually, so far, we can even describe it as a failed revolution because it brought another dictator. So Morsi is a continuation of the Mubarak regime, only with a different face. But he is not interested in democracy. He's a dictator. His loyalty is to the Murshid, who's the equivalent of the Ayatollah in Iran. And he will not, this president, who's a member of a criminal enterprise, the Muslim Brotherhood, is not interested in democracy. So this is a power grab. The people can see through it. The seculars must continue the revolution. The only question remains, is there a solution, a peaceful solution to this revolution? And I don't think that there is a peaceful resolution. There's going to have to be some kind of confrontation in the long run.
Well, Abdullah, I thank you for the call. Almost antithetical to the previous caller, who sees this as merely a kind of temporary hiccup, almost. Let me go to Stephen Cook on this. Are we talking about really just another replication of dictatorship, another kind of Mubarak with a different face, as the caller said, Stephen Cook?
I think it's entirely unclear. I think the Muslim Brotherhood's democratic credentials are certainly not well established. However, what we see happening in Egypt may be something where Egyptians will not accept a new kind of dictatorship under the Muslim Brotherhood. It may not be up to the Muslim Brotherhood how the political system ultimately shapes itself out. There is a constitutional process. Egyptians are they have been mobilized as a result of the uprising. They are not, as many have said over many years, you know, naturally interested in stability and don't want change. In fact, Egyptians have been rising up against the people who've ruled them for the better part of the last century or so. So I think under these circumstances, after the great promise of Tahrir Square, I think it would be very, very hard for some new dictator to emerge to put together some sort of political system that is Mubarakism without Mubarak, or a Muslim Brotherhood authoritarian, you know, religious kind of authoritarianism without a significant response from at least large sections of the Egyptian population.
Soraya, let me go to you on this. Soraya Sarhadi Nelson in Cairo. How do you see things, particularly in terms of the supporters of President Morsi? Would they like to see, you know, a Sharia law dictatorship in Egypt? Is that in the cards for them?
I honestly think, I mean, one has to remember that the Muslim Brotherhood does have a very robust political organization and political base, which explains why they are in power right now. None of the people who actually did this revolution ever came around to creating enough of a political base to be able to do anything. I mean, even political parties, you know, it was all sort of like, well, we're too busy in the square to deal with that sort of thing. And so I honestly think that a lot of this base, they're counting on the Brotherhood to do what it did at a time when it was banned, which was doing a lot of social outreach, sort of being there for people, you know, buying fuel, buying food. I mean, we can sit here and argue about, you know, constitution and that sort of thing. But I promise you that in this country of 80 plus million people, that 99% of them just want stability. They want, you know, jobs. They want food. And it isn't important to them, you know, the details or the intricacy about is this, you know, is this inside the Constitution or is this not? I don't think they have. I mean, this is a very largely illiterate population here as well. You know, it's too esoteric for them. And I think that is what the Brotherhood is banking on. I do think that, you know, this is a predominantly Muslim country, and while it's a moderate Muslim country, and I think a lot of people we saw in the square, or that I saw in the square tonight, they describe themselves as, you know, we're Egyptian moderates, we're out here tonight. But, you know, they do take pride in Islam. They would like Sharia to be the basis of the Constitution. It is now, but it's not because they're looking for that sort of what we identify as extremism or whatever. And I actually, I mean, the Brotherhood is historically a more pragmatic organization. It's not the Salafists. It's not, you know, I mean, they're not. There isn't Wahhabism. So I don't, you know, I think that's an important argument, and I think a lot of attention has to be paid to it. But I do think that in the end, you know, at least what I'm hearing is that people will be willing to accept some autocracy, you know, some Sharia, whatever, as long as there's some stability in this country. That is what people want.
And speaking about stability in the country, somebody named Elaine wrote on our website, and I'll go to you on this, Soraya. Elaine says she's visiting Egypt in less than 10 days with a group tour, and she was informed the sites that they'll be visiting are far away from the protesters, such as Tahrir Square, should be safe enough. Do you think it's safe to travel?
Well, I'm here. I came from Berlin. No, I mean, I actually find Egypt to be quite safe. I did notice something tonight that I should note. When I went to the square, and, you know, I, as an American reporter, I'm trying to get some comments. During the earlier days or earlier months or even the first year of the revolution, people were very eager to speak to an American audience. They wanted to reach out to people abroad. People tonight did not want to talk to me. I was really having an awfully hard time finding anyone, willing to speak to an American outlet or be willing to speak English. And there are a lot of people in that square tonight who do speak English. I mean, this is a very educated, again, secular crowd. So there's a lot of, I think, disillusionment with foreigners, and particularly the United States at the moment.
Well, having excuse me, how much of that is disillusionment and how much is fear?
I think it's disillusionment. I mean, no one's afraid to talk anymore. This is, I guess, what they call democracy. It is amazing. Even when you watch state television, you watch people screaming left and right. You know, this never existed during Mubarak's era. I mean, you know, you really had to be very careful about what you said because you often disappeared if you did say something. And no one has, I mean, you know, people here are all, whatever side of the spectrum you're on, they're all talking. So, no, I really do feel, I mean, I sort of saw people kind of pull back and sort of have that look on their face like, oh, American, forget it. And it was a very strange, you know, switch, if you will, from what I saw in the early days of the revolution.
Again, we're talking with Soraya Sarhadi Nelson, who's with us from Cairo, and you can be with us as well. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786 if you'd like to join the program, or you can email us forum@kqed.org, and we'll go to Shabazz. Shabazz, join us.
Hi, good morning. How you doing today?
Morning. Okay.
Yeah, forgive me if I sound like a conspiracy theorist, but, you know, here's how I see the whole situation ending up in Egypt. You know, immediately after the Obama was elected to the presidency, he takes some unnecessary trip over to Peru or somewhere. Simultaneously, Israel starts to bomb Gaza, and then they bring in Hillary Clinton and Morsi, who has no experience, in my estimation, in terms of negotiating peace on that particular level. So I think Hillary Clinton is the one who did the bulk of the negotiation. So Morsi goes back and takes over as a dictator, and the people of Egypt have another Mubarak, who was nothing but a puppet between Israel and the United States. And I think that people should start looking at it in that light, or that is as good a scenario as any other scenario to take notice of, and the United States, last but not least, the United States comes out in nearly mild fashion. I mean, don't forget that Egypt is a beneficiary of the United States, but we are so mealy mouthed in condemning Morsi's takeover as a dictator, as if to give the impression that we don't like it, but we're not really out there saying that we don't like it. So the only way the U.S. can get out of this situation, I think, is to condemn that dictatorship takeover, because that's all it is. It's going to be another Hosni Mubarak-type form of government between Egypt, Israel, and the United States manipulating the people.
Well, I thank you for the call, Shabazz. Of course, Senator John McCain has been calling for a pullback on foreign aid and the like. We're walking a tightrope here, though, Stephen Cook, because we really don't know what's going to unfurl.
Well, we certainly don't. And transitions from authoritarianism have great leaps forward and setbacks and so on and so forth. But to the caller's comment, I think in the narrative that he tells, there is an extremely important point, and that is, will the United States, important question, will the United States fall back on past policies? Morsi has demonstrated in the course of the last 10 days that he can be a very important diplomatic partner with the United States in the Israeli-Palestinian arena. Is that going to trump once again, as it has for previous decades, the demands of Egyptian people to live in more open democratic society? And the fear is in Cairo right now is that because Morsi played a central diplomatic role last week in the Israel-Gaza situation, that the White House is reluctant to take him to task for what are clearly authoritarian decrees and reluctant to voice concerns about the direction in which he seems to be taking Egypt at the moment.
Could I just clarify something with you, Stephen Cook? I mean, as a historian of Egypt's, going way back to the early 50s, a listener wrote on a website, apparently I had said something, and if I misspoke, I'd like to get that corrected, because I do like to think I have journalistic integrity, about the Muslim Brotherhood being involved in the assassination of Anwar Sadat. And this listener says that is not the case, that the last time, according to Joel Benin, whom he quotes, a Stanford professor, last time the Muslim Brotherhood was accused of any violent act was back in 1954. I do recall, I should probably look this up again, but there was fingers pointed in the Sadat assassination of the Muslim Brotherhood, weren't they?
Well, the assassination of Sadat was carried out by essentially members of two crossover organizations, the Jihad organization and what's called the Gamia Islamia. Members of these organizations were people who were radicalized by the crackdown on the Brotherhood in the 1950s, and they became offshoots. But the Brotherhood itself was not directly involved in the assassination of Sadat. That said, subsequently, Mubarak and the people around him had always used the excuse of terrorism for crackdowns on the Muslim Brotherhood, although there's no evidence that the Brotherhood had engaged in any kind of violence since the 1950s and formally renounced it in the 1970s.
All right, glad to get that clarification. Let me get another caller on, and we go to William in Belvedere. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, and thank you very much. I certainly would never question your journalistic integrity, but I would appreciate any of the guest perceptions about something that you said early on in the show. It was a simple statement. It said, Egypt needs the United States. Now, since you
should I clarify that? I think economically, Egypt gets a lot of money from the United States.
I'm glad, because I'm assuming that's what you meant.
Exactly.
I was checking, and the U.S. aid to Egypt constitutes less than 0.25% of its gross domestic product. But beyond that, since we've all heard so much about Egypt since the Arab Spring, what's come across to me from an economic standpoint is that there's a small number of people, significantly those in the military, who seem to control a great deal of the wealth and the industry that exists in Egypt. Perhaps your correspondent who's there at this time could comment on that. And since that really is the basis, as I would see it, of the economic problems experienced by the average Egyptians, then I wonder whether it really is true that that Egypt needs U.S. economic aid rather than that Egypt needs to get its act together from an economic standpoint to benefit its public. But I do know who does need U.S. economic aid, and that's our own school districts, where often half of the children are in poverty. That's sort of an aside, but I think it is related. So I'd appreciate the guest's perception about that.
Now, let me go to you, Soraya, on this. Soraya Saadi Nelson?
That is part of the complaint that people here have with the Morsi government and with the Muslim Brotherhood, is that the money, the $1 billion or whatever that's funneled into the military, and also that this black economy or secret economy, if you will. I mean, the military does bottled water. In fact, they do what I would argue is the second best tasting bottled water here in Egypt. They make concrete. They make refrigerators. They're very much involved, and they have gas stations. You know, that has continued, and that hasn't really changed. And in fact, when they were deciding initially about how they would handle budgets and the like, the military budget is still going to be off limits and not subject to overview and oversight. And so I think there was some disappointment that did not change. But, you know, having said that, I don't think I agree that the aid that's given to the given from the United States is that inconsequential here. I mean, I can't do the numbers for you right now off the top of my head. But certainly Egypt is on the precipice in terms, I mean, they don't have much left in cash reserves. I mean, the value of the Egyptian pound has come down quite a bit since all this transition has been taking place. And the economy is front and foremost on the minds of people here. I mean, I can't, whether I'm going out with a driver or a taxi driver or going to a store, that's all anybody is talking about is this fear. And I think that creates this dependence and this acceptance that, yes, we do need America, but people do want this government to stand up and say, we're not just going to throw it all at the military. The military doesn't get to take all the money. It's not all just about military hardware and making sure the military stays robust. And they want to see the Morsi government tackle this. But I don't think the Morsi government, considering what's happening right now, really has the power to do that.
Well, Professor Tahami, I believe no country gets more foreign aid than Egypt other than Israel, which gets more foreign aid. But when you break it down, just how necessary is that aid to Egypt's ongoing struggles economically? Oh, I'm sorry. We're going to have to reconnect with Professor Tahami. Stephen Cook?
Well, the aid package is currently $1.5 billion a year. $1.3 of those billion goes directly to the military for a variety of programs, including the purchase of tanks and airplanes and so on and so forth. And you've got about $250 million going towards what's arguably economic support, but it really is for programs like good governance programs and a variety of other things. At one time in the mid-1980s, we were giving Egypt about $1 billion worth of economic aid, but that was at a time when the Egyptian economy was much, much smaller than it is now. But Soraya Sahadi Nelson is precisely correct. The Egyptians have run through more than half of their foreign currency reserves. They need the United States more than anything, not because this is such a huge amount of money, but because the U.S. investment in Egypt unlocks other things, like IMF loans, investment from other countries.
Excuse me, Stephen, they just got a $4.8 billion
IMF
loan. That's
right, and that's because the United States has committed to continue its relationship, its aid relationship with Egypt. The United States has a lot of influence at the International Monetary Fund, and although it was a difficult negotiation with the IMF, ultimately the United States and the arguments about the necessity of the aid carried the day. I think, though, that there is going to be a fight ultimately about the direction of economic policymaking in Egypt, because the caller said something about getting Egypt to do the right thing. Well, in fact, over the course of 25 years, but in particular the last decade, the Egyptian government under Mubarak pursued neoliberal economic policies that, to your average Egyptian, impoverished them, that made them worse off than they are. And I think that despite the IMF loan, there is going to be economic policymaking that's going to try to, if not roll back this kind of economic reform program, but do things that Egyptians can't necessarily afford in terms of economic policymaking. And I think it's going to diverge from the kinds of prescriptions that the United States and the IMF and the World Bank have traditionally given the Egyptians about how to move forward economically.
Let me move forward to another caller. And Corey, thank you for waiting. Join us on Forum. Good morning.
No problem. Thank you. I had a question for Mrs. Nelson. You had made a comment that Egyptian people in Tahrir Square wouldn't speak to you because they felt disillusioned about Americans. I wanted to know what you were referring to. Obviously, historically, they might be disillusioned with us, but it sounded like you were speaking about something more recently.
Well, basically, there's great disappointment from the top on down about the lack of American reaction. I guess at the beginning of the revolution, they felt America didn't speak up quickly enough to support what was happening in the streets. They feel right now that America is not saying anything about Mr. Morsi and what he's doing, that they're being, you know, that they're being too cautious. And there also, I should mention that the government here, you know, whether it was SCAF, whether it's now the Morsi government, they keep playing on people's fears, sort of stoking the xenophobia, if you will, saying all the trouble that you see, the violent clashes, bloodshed, whatever, it's all caused by foreign elements, ergo, you know, the United States. And so there's this sort of disillusionment, if you will, with the United States. It was very palpable to me today. I've been gone for a few months because I'm on assignment elsewhere at the moment, and I have just come back for this story. And I really noticed the difference. And again, it took me like 8 tries to finally find someone who spoke English, and I almost shamed him into like talking to me by saying, "How am I going to explain to people why you're in the square tonight if nobody will talk to me?" And I mean, it was very, I mean, to me, it was very startling. I had not experienced it to this level
before. I feel your pain. let me thank Corey for the call and the question, and let me go to another caller. Ed, good morning.
Good morning. You know, I disagree with both women in your show. Really, really, I disagree. I have family in Egypt, and one of my nieces, extremely politically active. They love to talk to Americans. I don't know where some men go to. And also, most Egyptians are totally unhappy with the Islamic Brotherhood government, totally unhappy, and they hate Morsi up to the extreme. In fact, my niece, I can get her on Facebook through Sasu So, S-A-S-O, So. And everybody angry. Egypt always was a secular country. It always will remain a secular country. It doesn't have Sharia law. It will never have Sharia law. Only 25% of Egyptians voted, and that's why the Muslim Brotherhood won, because most people do not like the choice they had. A Mubarak-like guy and Islamic Brotherhood. Yeah, I think Morsi is going to be gone sometime very soon, and everybody should support the Egyptian revolution. Egypt old flag with crescent and three stars. One star for Islam, one star for Christianity, one star for Judaism. Egypt will never be the Islamic Republic of Egypt, and Morsi should pack up his stuff and go. Please do. But I'm really disappointed with the many comments the two women in your show have done. I think they're promoting their own agenda, not the Egyptian agenda, and that's a shame, because people in Egypt are suffering a lot to prove the revolution, and they will succeed.
I've got to defend, I don't know, the two women you're referring to. There's only woman here is Soraya, and speaking about journalistic
I'm such a presence that they think I'm too.
Well, speaking about journalistic integrity, yours is unimpeachable, so we'll move on from there. But I'm also wondering, since the caller brings it up, we've got just seconds left, what the attitude is of the Coptic Christians and those minorities in Egypt who have been, well, victims to some extent, ongoing.
You're asking me?
Sorry, yeah, Soraya, quickly if you could.
Yeah, yeah. They are very upset. I mean, they are very much distrustful and angry at Mr. Morsi, and they do feel that there is an Islamist agenda here, not an agenda for Egypt, but an agenda for Islam. And they're very concerned about that. And so there are people here who would like to see him go, and certainly I would say the majority of Copts are among them.
Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson, again with us from Cairo, thank you so much for being with us on Forum. Appreciate your being with us. Also want to extend my thanks to Stephen A. Cook, Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies, again author of The Struggle for Egypt, From Nasser to Tahrir Square, and Shibli Tahami, Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development, University of Maryland, and Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution. His new book, co-authored, is The Peace Puzzle, America's Quest for Arab-Israeli Peace, 1989 to 2011. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank Senior Editor Dan Zoll and our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.